For War News Radio at Swarthmore College, I'm Sarah Tupchong.
And I'm Catherine Kwok.
The breakthrough nuclear deal established between Iran, the U.S., and five other nations last week has continued to face criticism at home and abroad, even as diplomats work forward towards a final deal. The framework limits Iran's ability to produce nuclear weapons in exchange for the gradual lifting of international sanctions. Now, negotiators have until June 30th to finalize the deal. Although Congress is on a break until April 14th, the White House is already working to sell the deal to Congress. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has actively campaigned against the framework, specifically citing the fact that it does not guarantee Iran's recognition of the State of Israel. Facing this criticism, President Obama has stated in interviews with NPR and the New York Times that this deal is critical to the future of relations between the U.S. and Iran, but that the U.S. is still committed to Israel. Obama has also met with members of the Gulf Cooperation Council to discuss the framework. If the deal goes through, reduced sanctions may cause Iran's economy to gain as much as $60 billion from foreign investment in the petroleum sector alone. These economic repercussions could threaten the oil and gas export markets of Gulf Cooperation Council states such as Saudi Arabia.
Aden, a southern city in Yemen where violence between Houthi militants and local militia continues to intensify, received medical aid for the first time since conflict broke out. Doctors Without Borders has sent a 2.5-ton shipment of medicine and a team of surgeons, according to the Red Cross. At least 74 children have been killed in Yemen since the Saudi-led airstrikes against Houthis forces began. According to UNICEF, around 100,000 Yemenis in total have been displaced since the start of the conflict. Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter recently stated that the U.S. intelligence has observed al-Qaeda using the conflict to make further gains in Yemen. Carter went on to say that the U.S. will continue to supply intelligence and arms to the Saudis.
Iran needs to recognize that the United States is not going to stand by while the region is destabilized.
Secretary of State Kerry, speaking this week, Iran denies that it is aiding the Houthis, but has sent two Navy vessels to the Gulf of Aden. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani has called for a ceasefire in Yemen.
Newly elected Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has pledged to spare no effort to defeat Boko Haram. Buhari has asserted that he intends for Nigeria to take the lead in the multinational fight against the terrorist organization. He criticized Nigeria's dependence on Chad under previous President Goodluck Jonathan, but does not plan to abandon international cooperation. Buhari, a retired major general in the Nigerian army, served as head of state once before a military coup d'etat in 1983. Boko Haram continues to be a threat, however, carrying out a number of attacks in Borno State this week. In one attack, at least 24 civilians were killed when Boko Haram militants who were disguised as preachers gathered people at a mosque and then opened fire on them. The UN Security Council condemned these attacks and called upon West and Central African states to develop cooperation and a common strategy against Boko Haram.
Fighting has continued in the Iraqi city of Tikrit since government forces recaptured the city from ISIS control. Looting and arson have prevented residents from returning to their homes, and Iraqi officials claim that some houses have been specifically targeted for being known ISIS associates. Some residents, however, suggest that they are being targeted over personal grudges held by the regional police force. Iraq has also launched an attack against ISIS near the city of Ramadi against the Islamic State. It is unclear if this assault is only a preliminary operation or the beginning of a larger offensive to retake the Anbar province. On the same day as the Iraqi offensive began, ISIS released 216 Yazidi prisoners, mostly elderly and children. No explanation was given for the release, and many show signs of abuse and neglect, according to a northern Iraqi commander. The Yazidis, a Kurdish religious community, were captured in August during the Islamic State's takeover of the area near the Iraqi-Syrian border. This is the second group of Yazidi prisoners to be freed. The first release occurred last January.
Kenya struck back against militant Islamic group Al-Shabaab this week, 4 days after an attack on a university in the northeastern city of Garissa left nearly 150 dead. On Monday, Kenya launched airstrikes in neighboring Somalia, targeting Al-Shabaab camps. Two of the group's camps were destroyed, according to an army spokesperson, but an eyewitness claimed that the attacks wounded at least three civilians as well. Al-Shabaab leaders have promised to escalate violence in Kenya, while President Uhuru Kenyatta said the country will respond in, quote, the severest ways possible.
This week, Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras met with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Moscow to discuss the diplomatic relationship between the two countries. Although the European Union is currently engaged in sanctions against Russia, Tsipras' left-wing Syriza party has made a point of expressing political support for Russia since winning January elections. Russian Agricultural Minister Nikolai Fyodorov recently announced that Russia may end its ban on Western food imports earlier for Greece, as well as Hungary and Cyprus. Although Greece will likely need new loans after its bailout extension expires in June, Prime Minister Tsipras did not publicly request funding from Russia during his visit. Instead, Greece and Russia have agreed to work on economic projects, including a pipeline through Turkey that would deliver Russian gas to Europe. The question remains, however, where Greece will look for funds to address its debt of 450 million euros to the IMF.
This week, War News Radio is presenting content from our partner radio station Yatsani FM in Lusaka, Zambia. We bring to you content from reporter Maybeen Katungulu on deforestation.
Currently, Zambia has approximately 50 million hectares of forest, but findings indicate that the country is losing forests between 250,000 to 300,000 hectares per year as a result of deforestation. Charcoal burning and agricultural activities are among major factors contributing towards deforestation in Zambia. Now, an environmental advocate, Robert Chimambo, says Zambia needs forestry to mitigate the impact of climate change effects such as floods and droughts.
But if we had forest growing, they will mitigate the impact of whether it's floods. As you know, for Zambia, it will be either floods, intense floods, or droughts, intense droughts. That is how climate change will impact us. But with the forests, they will help to mitigate our forests. So we can be able to recharge a lot of water. If there were a good year of rain, with the forest, it will soak in the water and we'll have water. Even if the following year we have a drought. But if the forests are healthy and intact, we are safe moving forward 5, 10, 20 years.
Mr. Chimambo, who is also a member of Zambia Climate Change Network, is of the view that deforestation can only be curtailed by providing a policy direction that allows community participation. He explains to this reporter that providing alternative source of energy is the solution to the current problem of deforestation in the country.
Create a friendly environment where the communities participate. I mean, once we have done what we have saying, the rest is easy. The community will just fall in place. It is a policy issue. The policy, a friendly policy must be put in place. Otherwise, I mean, how else can you stop our people in Baoleni from using charcoal? Because charcoal is what is available.
250,000 to 300,000 hectares of forest being lost per year in Zambia is certainly worrying. It is hoped that necessary measures will be put in place to stop this scourge. Reporting for SN News in Lusaka, I am Maybeen Augustine Katungulu.
You just heard a piece on deforestation from Byakzana FM in Lusaka, Zambia. Next, War News Radio's Sarah Morell and Jay Clayton present Filibusted, an editorial segment dedicated to the news that makes you want to tear your hair out.
And now, historic update coming to you live from War News Radio's Filibusted.
I can't wait to tell our listeners all about Putin's sudden reappearance.
Wait, no, Sarah, have you gone and joined the Indiana Mole Women? That happened 3 weeks ago.
Cut me some slack, Jay. I traveled all the way to Siberia for a special Putin report.
I wondered where you'd gone. But you have to have heard about the momentous deal that was reached this past week, right? With Iran?
No, I was pretty undercover for this investigation. I was disguised as a Russian midwife, trying to prove that Putin had disappeared because he fathered a love child.
And how did that go?
Yeah, Filibusted hasn't done investigative journalism before for a reason.
Well, I'm pretty sure BuzzFeed News isn't censored in Russia. Anyway, so Iran agreed on a framework for a deal with the US, the EU, China, and Russia. In this deal, Iran would lose much of its potential to enrich uranium. It could only enrich up to 3.67%, which is enough for nuclear energy. The International Atomic Energy Agency, meanwhile, will conduct regular investigations, and in return, the US, EU, and UN will lift their sanctions against Iran.
Oh yeah, someone mentioned that in Moscow, but my Russian's a little rusty.
You went deep undercover in Russia? Without knowing any Russian? Sarah, what are you, Sterling Archer?
Yeah, I wouldn't be caught dead pounding back Bloody Marys. Please. but this deal seems surprisingly robust, especially given the historically tense relations between Iran and the US. I mean, Iran is giving up 97% of its currently enriched uranium.
The inspections alone are pretty striking. Iran is much less likely to try and cheat on any part of the deal if there are regular inspections of their nuclear facilities.
And I'm sure that absolutely everyone is impressed with the checks built into this deal. Who would ever have a problem with that?
Do you want their names in alphabetical order or by the number of mushroom cloud images on their Facebook pages?
Well, we can start with the list of 47 Republican senators who literally wrote a letter to the Iranian government, kindly reminding them that the U.S. has elections and Obama will be leaving soon.
Ah, yes, because Iran has never had elections.
In fact, their most recent presidential election had 72.71% voter turnout. The U.S. only had 57.5% in 2012.
And the sabotage hasn't ended now that a hopeful deal has been reached. All the potential Republican candidates for the 2016 presidential elections have made bad-mouthing the deal the reason why you should pay attention to them.
For example, Senator Marco Rubio immediately came out against the deal, calling it an example of diplomatic failure and a farcical approach to Iran.
Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, meanwhile, tweeted, "Obama's dangerous deal with Iran rewards an enemy, undermines our allies, and threatens our safety."
This coming from the man who thinks that his experience busting unions and being a Boy Scout qualifies him to take on the Islamic State.
Obama's not the only political leader sticking his neck out to make this deal work, though. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani is also getting pushback from domestic conservatives. The editor of Kayhan, a leading right-wing Iranian paper, has already denounced the deal, saying, "We gave up a race-ready horse, and we got in return a broken bridle."
Iranian members of parliament, just like their counterparts in Congress, are demanding the right to amend or reject the deal.
Now, we're not saying that the Iranian and American right wing are the same, but we've never seen them in the same room at the same time.
Yeah, and they all work together to fake the moon landing. But this is also important for understanding how uncertain the lasting effects of the deal really are. Rouhani and Obama are in the same boat, both having to convince their opposition leaders and constituencies that this is a legitimate political move and an important step forward.
And look, we're not saying this is a perfect deal. There are some serious limitations.
Most importantly, we don't know at what stage in the deal sanctions against Iran would be lifted. The debate is currently over whether sanctions will go away as soon as Iran begins to comply, or once Iran has met every term in the final plan.
So yeah, there are reasons for both sides to worry about this deal. In any negotiation, both sides compromise, but both sides also give something up.
Not that congressional Republicans would know anything about the art of compromise.
Yeah, they can't exactly shut down the Iranian government in protest, can they?
Guess they have to resign themselves to more strongly worded letters?
Or they could threaten all-out war.
Well, that escalated quickly. Guess I'm a little behind on the social niceties of warfare.
Dear sir, you have offended me most greatly, and so I formally declare that I will launch strategic airstrikes upon your entire country.
But seriously, less than 2 weeks ago, former United Nations Ambassador John Bolton wrote a charming piece in the New York Times titled, "To Stop Iran's Bomb, Bomb Iran."
An old Beach Boys song, Bomb Iran. Bomb, bomb, bomb. Anyway.
Remember that? That was John McCain back on the campaign trail in 2007. Unsurprisingly, he was one of the 47 senators who sent that letter to Iran.
But it's also indicative of the American tendency to treat Iran as a timeless enemy. Iran is the axis of evil. And part of what that means is that American politicians and pundits are perfectly willing to constantly threaten military action against Iran.
And part of the way they justify this is by always saying that Iran has threatened war. But when you look more closely, often it turns out that Iran has basically said, "If you attack us, we're going to strike back."
Like in 2012, when all the American news stations were talking about then-President Ahmadinejad's threat to launch ballistic missiles at the U.S. Ignoring the part where he said this would be a response to an all-out war by the United States and Israel.
And the other problem with treating Iran as an eternal enemy is that it ignores literally 60 years of history.
Overthrowing someone's government may get you invited to all your puppet rulers' parties, but you can't be surprised if that doesn't last very long.
And I bet we've missed out on some real ragers since the revolution. The Ayatollah really knows his way around a flower arrangement.
And let's get real here. It's not like we politely ignored them after 1979. For example, in 1988, the U.S. Navy shot down Iran Air Flight 655, killing 290 people, including 66 children.
And we know what you're thinking. Is there proof that was us? We did just imply that we don't believe in the moon landing. But don't worry. The U.S. Navy gave the commander of the ship that shot down the flight the Legion of Merit.
And we already mentioned in a previous show that the United States sold Saddam Hussein chemical weapons to use against Iran in the Iran-Iraq War.
That's a first for filibusted. Continuity.
I don't know, we do keep on bringing up tequila and Lunchables.
Thinking about Iran as the ultimate bad guy is just part of this larger problem with how we talk about foreign powers in the Middle East, where we treat them as inflexible, alien, incapable of understanding or conforming to our values, and therefore devilishly cunning.
For example, last week, Time magazine published a piece by former Israeli ambassador to the United States, Michael Oren, titled, "The Iran Deal and How Not to Buy a Middle Eastern Carpet." It refers to Iran as expert carpet merchants who, as we know, cheat.
I mean, this Orientalist malarkey isn't even subtle.
This is what happens when we can't swear on the air. I was personally partial to hogwash or balderdash myself.
And it's not like this deal is going to radically change how we talk about Iran. The deal actually reinforces a lot of the ways the U.S. interacts with countries in the region.
This deal, on some level, is just another way that the United States can bring countries into its sphere of influence. Inspections are a way to ensure compliance, but they also reflect a pattern of control. Iran has two options. Either they're our enemy, or they need to cave to our wishes. And the Republican right doesn't even think this deal is enough.
We think that this deal is a really important step forward. If it succeeds, it has really amazing potential. But if it doesn't, if a deal falls apart, there's a real risk of war here. And we shouldn't assume that Iran would start it.
Wow, Jay, you're really letting me leave Filibusted on a positive note.
Great summary. For Filibusted, I'm Jay Clayton.
And I'm Sarah Morrell. Signing off for the last time before graduation. As always, it's been a pleasure. At least for us.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Mayank Agrawal, Amy DePiro, John Gagnon, Allison Raybar, Sabrina Merrill, Joseph Millman, Amber Sheth, and Tyler Welsh.
This week's show was produced by Leo Elliott. I'm Catherine Kwok.
And I'm Sarah Tupchong. Until next time, thanks for listening.